here and not in the next room. Have you noticed who's gathered in the next room? They're called rich dads. So, notwithstanding the fact that I did suggest to Tony Gallagher that perhaps we need a kind of intergenerational equity tax, which would say all them, those aged four, sort of 45 to 70, should pay in perpetuity a graduate tax, if they were graduates, but not the younger generation, because they had. Because I worked out that my benefit, by the way, in that respect, was £100,000 in grant and fees at present levels. So the state gave me £100,000 to become a graduate. So I can see you're all very enthusiastic about that. So there we go. But you'd only pay it if you were on the 40% range, and only if you were a graduate. However, that's taking inclusion too far, it seems to me. And I wanted just to say something about... you were familiar, I'm sure, at least I noticed secondary schools in the post-primary schools in England often have this on their staff room notice board. It's very rarely on a primary school. But it's from Gino, and it says, "I come to the frightening conclusion I'm the decisive element in the classroom. It's my personal approach that makes the climate. It's my daily mood that makes the weather. As a teacher, I possess tremendous power to make a child's life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humour, hurt or heal. In all situations, it's my response that decides whether a crisis will be escalated or de-escalated, a child humanised or dehumanised." And on the primary side, I find this in the primary classrooms, which is a focus on the child rather than the teacher. And it's that one, and I notice it a lot. And it is a case that these two quotes get done, Gino's first one and this one, as you can see from a Chilean. "Mankind owes to the children the best it has to give. Their life is fragile. If they have a tomorrow, their needs must be met today. Many things can wait, but not the children. Now is the time. Their bones are being formed, their blood composed, and their senses developed. We cannot answer their tomorrows, their name is today." And really, I put those two up because, in a way, the battle for inclusion is won or lost, it seems to me, during those years when 15% of kids' waking time is spent in schools and 85% of the time is spent, their waking time, is spent at home or in the community. And that 15% has got an extra value. We all know that because there's there's absolutely plain, focused effort at developing the child during those periods. And therefore, the attitudes that teacher strikes and the view that they take of the child as needing something today rather than putting it off is crucial in the inclusion agenda. And that's where, it seems to me, most of our battles are won or lost. That's where our adult attitudes come from. I'm not denying that, of course, we change with time. But nevertheless, it's there that it really has to be won. And, we were talking the other day, a group of us, about... leadership, and we were saying that that stuff you do with Belbin or there's an Myers-Briggs, those things where you can profile people and you decide in your leadership team who's got what and where your gaps are. I was working with somebody when I was in Birmingham, and she reminded me, I've never forgotten it, we were talking about it the other day, that really, on the whole, leadership can be clearly analysed, not by that. She said, look, what we're doing, Tim, is crap. I mean, what you really ought to be doing is something quite different, which is what the infant teacher does, that she focuses on whether a child is developing and thinking and learning as they develop their speaking skills, their listening skills, their reading skills, and their writing skills. And if you think about leaders, unless they're doing all those four things, then you're in trouble. And I thought, well, that's quite a good description, actually, because you know that bit, I don't know whether you've got it, which is that we certainly got it, which is that kids at 11, 12, on transfer, their reading is better developed than their writing, and their writing is lagging behind. And if you sort of think of the role model of the teacher in a later primary school, if you were a child of 11, you'd think, well, what an amazing speaker, what an amazing listener, what an amazing reader, seems to have read everything, speaks really, an amazing writer, query. The very best teachers model writing for 11, and there are very few do that, at least in England. It's the neglected art of the skill of a teacher. And I think that the great danger is that not here as much as is the case across the water, which is that the reading and the writing tend to get neglected. And that's why people taking further qualification and so on are really, it's a really important feature. And how many of us, when we've had teachers who'd come to do a postgraduate qualification, they're always very hesitant about their writing. I haven't written anything for years, they say. And that's a really serious issue. One of the things that we got up to in London, and we were that I wondered whether has wider application, I think that the Scots are doing it, I'm not absolutely sure they're doing it the same way, was that we decided that what we had to do in order to effect improvement was to get all the teachers not to become isolated as they had, because the Inner London Education Authority had now broken up into 32 London boroughs. There were the outer London boroughs that were always there, fairly large, but then there were 10 inner London boroughs. And under the impact of the thing I was talking about last night, choice and diversity of provision, schools have become incredibly competitive one with another, and they've become isolated. So that the solutions to particular issues in London schooling were in the schools, but they were closely guarded secrets, and schools were not prepared to share. So one of the issues was, well, how do you get people to share? And we approached it by providing them with data that they'd never had before about performance in different schools, whether it was attendance, whatever it was. We came up with a families of schools document, so to enable them to go and look at each other's practice. But we also decided, and this was a contentious thing to say, not in London, but it was if you said it outside, was you'd have a group of teachers there and you'd say, look, you clearly need a lot more skill and a lot more knowledge to be an effective teacher in London than you do perhaps in rural Suffolk. That's unfair to rural Suffolk. But what I was getting at was this, that there were 300 languages and there were almost as many different cultures in the classroom. And that, frankly, if you were going to if you were going to succeed as a teacher, you were always trying, weren't you, to strike the illustrations in a way which would resonate with an individual child. And if you struck only one image, then you are unintentionally excluding others. So it's at the heart of the inclusion agenda is an ever-widening knowledge of cultures, of race, and you could argue, as the inclusion agenda moves forward, of barriers to kids' learning. So what we decided to do was to set up a thing called the Chartered London Teacher, so that in their first 2 years of teaching, teachers would be expected to extend their knowledge and skill in these following areas. One was the generic teaching skill. Another was their subject knowledge, second. A third was whole school improvement issues. A fourth was barriers to children's learning. And a fifth was, frankly, culture and race. And the way that they would do it would be in groups of two and three, building a portfolio of their work in this respect and their reflections on how they'd extended their skills over a period of 2 years. We immediately had 30,000 teachers who decided to take it up out of a workforce of probably 40. So three quarters decided that they wanted to do this. It was open at that stage to all existing teachers as well, so that there would be an intergenerational solidarity in working with it. I do think that, and I wanted to make this point right at the beginning, that if we're going to make a dent in taking further the inclusion agenda, it's essential that we make sure that teachers in their first 2, 3, 4 years of teaching keep up the habits of looking, reflecting and research in those 5 areas, because they are their bread and butter. So I wanted to say that. And then I wanted to move on to, I don't know what they are. Are they values? Are they principles? Are they beliefs? Are they prejudices? I started on this when it's almost a moment's silence, because so many of our what were called quangos are now in their dying days. And QC, the Qualifications and Curriculum Authority, was one such body, and so was the National College. And when the Qualification and Curriculum Authority was set up, they said, could you write something about values? You're always on about shared values, they said. So I said, well, you know, this, by the way, was after I'd left Kiel and I was in the middle of Birmingham. And they said, well, surely you can write something. So I said, well, you know, I'm not really an academic. I'd only gone to Kiel. You'll forgive me for saying this, but I'd only gone to Kiel really as an administrator who had done Oxfordshire. And I was only at Kiel for a short time. Indeed, Kiel made me feel a bit like, I tell you what it reminded me of. It reminded me of being a PE teacher in a grammar school. That's how I was, you know. And they didn't. So when I left and I went to Birmingham, I was thinking, oh, I can shake all this academic stuff and I get back to being my old administrative self. And the chief executive said, you know, you were a professor in Kiel. So I said, yeah. He said, you know, they've asked you to carry on as a visiting professor. I said, yes. So he said, well, don't drop the title, will you? So I said, what do you mean, don't drop the title? So he said, well, I want you to carry on calling yourself a professor. So I said, why is that? So he said, well, population of Birmingham think we've got the real deal if we have a professor. So I settled it with it forever that I'm perpetually being held on to that title even when I don't really deserve it, because I'm only a very occasional visiting one at the Institute of Education now. Anyway, where was I? I was at the point where somebody said to me, look, you're on and on about shared values and values being essential to successful schools, etc., etc. Do you think you could write 3,000 words on it? I said, there's a hell of a lot of words to write about values. I said, I could write on values what I really know in about... And I said, I'm not an academic. They said, oh, it's all right, it's only for head teachers, so you needn't worry about it. So I wrote it, and I came up with this proposition, and I realised, of course, they're not values. Are they beliefs or prejudices, or what are they? But I think they're pretty important to the present debate. Are you really interested in success for everyone, not failure? I got into terrible trouble with Tony Blair, because when he came to power, do you remember he had a slogan, you perhaps missed it over here, which was success for the many, not the few. It was one of 17 propositions. And I wrote to him and said, look, this is absolutely brilliant. Just if it's success for the many, can you tell me the ones I forget about? Because then... Then I could not wait. And it sort of developed since then. And the story, certainly, I think, of English New Labour ministers is that they became slowly but genuinely moved towards, at least in belief, a realisation that we should be aiming for success for everyone. And you're going to say, hey, hold on, that's unrealistic. And what I'm trying to say about that is failure is fine, in the sense of it's an essential part of learning, i.e. I fail to learn something and you as my teacher are going to help me overcome that barrier to learning and go on. So there's a difference, isn't there, between failing to learn, which is fine, but learning to fail, which you wouldn't want for anyone. And that's where inclusion, it seems to me, comes in, because if you are trying to be inclusive, you're trying to offer the prospect of success, or at least not learning to be a failure, to everyone. So I think that's an important principle. And you can think of lots of school practices where you would say, hey, wait a minute, are they doing as much as they might do to eliminate the chance of a kid learning to be a failure? Or if they adjusted that practice, would that increase the likelihood? And right at the end, I want you to play around with warning now. I'm not going to talk for an hour. And you're thinking, thank God for that, right? I will want you to kind of think of the small things that you could do that you are not doing or that are getting in the way of inclusion in your daily practices. So you can think of that while you turn off while I finish. Secondly, do you believe in intelligence as a multifaceted, you know, the Howard Gardner notion? Do you believe in that as and without limit, as opposed to it being general, inherited and predictable? The predictable, I think, is tremendously important, because it's who would dare to put a limit at an early age, given what we know about the sudden changes that can occur during adolescence, for example, in attitude, etc., etc., and in apparently cognitive grasp. Who would dare to put a limit on it? How would you dare to say it's predictable? You go to almost any form of activities. I take grandchildren to athletics, and the athletic coaches are absolutely adamant that kids of 7, 8, 9 or 10 is not a good predictor of where they'll be when they're 18, 19 or 20. Not just simply on whether they stick with it, but there will be changes in what they can do. So they're not prepared to put predictability on it. I've got to say, in the schools that I see, secondary schools in particular, they're absolutely preoccupied by tests of different sorts of at 11, which then subliminally put a limit on what a child might expect. So I do definitely want to say, are teachers surrounded by practices that reinforce, if not the general, inherited and predictable, certainly the predictable, because there are, I think the use of schools by data is often with predictability in mind. So is it multifaceted and without limit? Then, of course, the heart of your debate is a school inclusive, not exclusive. And frequently, I don't know how it is over here, but in England, I would dare to say, and there'll be people here from England who will argue with me, that when we had those debates about inclusion, it was entirely down the lines of an argument about whether kids with special educational needs could or couldn't be included within the mainstream. We had those endless arguments, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is, you know, how are we talking on a locational basis? Are we talking on a social basis? Or are we talking on a functional basis in terms of inclusion? And people getting comfortable with, well, we could talk about the locational. That's not too threatening. Social gets a bit more threatening. Functional gets devilishly hard to do, given the circumstances we've got. So, but what I was getting at, and this was exactly what this Scotens has been about for years and years and years, which is inclusive on a wide scale, not a narrow scale, focusing on one particular issue. Not that that issue isn't hugely important, of course it is, but it affects, doesn't it, as I was saying right at the beginning, the teacher's use of language, the teacher's dispositions in the morning, the way kids are welcomed into the classroom or not, and how we know that that affects their performance, etc., etc. So what are we doing? The next one is ipsative and formative forms of assessment rather than normative and comparative. Now, I put that down, and I hope some people are puzzling about the word ipsative, not least because it doesn't exist. But I have been writing it for now 20 years, and it's my bid for immortality that eventually it will get in. And what I mean by that is the issue of against your own previous best, so that it's formative assessment and it's against your own previous best rather than normative and comparative. And you're going to say, hell, come on, you need normative and comparative, and indeed you do. But the judgment of the teacher and the judgment of the school has to be when to introduce assessment of kids, which is normative and comparative, but always trying to get them to do the ipsative and the formative, because it helps them focus on exactly where each individual child is and making sure that they're cutting and chipping themselves into the shape of the key which will unlock the mind and open the shut chambers of the heart as they're teaching. So the normative and comparative is this awful thing. You know, it again affects our use of language, doesn't it? I don't know whether John Anderson is going to admit that the inspectorate over here have made sure that the word satisfactory now means unsatisfactory. I don't know whether you... But certainly in England... Is it true, John?
Satisfactory is not good enough.
Yes, that's right. I knew, really, that you had redone the English language. And that's fine with me. In a way, I admire that kind of debate about what satisfactory is, because have you come across that lovely poem, which I first came across in America and Kansas, The Average Child? I don't cause teachers trouble. My grades have been okay. I listen in my classes. I'm in school every day. My teachers think I'm average. My parents think so too. I wish I didn't know that, because there's lots I'd like to do. I'd like to build a rocket, have a book that shows you how, or start a stamp collection. Well, no use in trying now, because since I've found I'm average, I'm just smart enough, you see, to know there's nothing special that I should expect of me. I'm part of that majority. This is a little couplet for Northern Ireland. I'm part of that majority, that hump part of the bell, who spends their life unnoticed in an average kind of hell. It's a guy who I heard in Kansas, and we traded it, and I came over here and spread it around, and some of you have heard it, so obviously that's worked, but I think it's fantastic little verse to because the first move, if you look at kids who in their very earliest years, I'm talking about in childhood as opposed to infancy, who are beginning to learn to be failures, often their first move in that direction is to say, well, I'm only average. And then they're on to, I'm not as good as them at anything at all. So it's important. And then finally, do we believe that education is lifelong, not once and for all? I think that's a terribly inclusive, a tremendously inclusive proposition, because it avoids you reinforcing the notion of kids thinking, I've had it. So that the notion that people can be lifelong learners is tremendously important. And it would lead you at secondary school, wouldn't it? And it would lead you at primary school to have on your wall the achievements of past pupils. So you would have walls full of the achievements. And I know that I can suggest this north and south, and you'll do it tomorrow, you know those lovely graduation ceremonies where everybody's having a wonderful time? You'll promise me that next year one thing you'll do is to persuade your university authorities to take a picture. They take pictures of all the graduates, and to send a picture of the graduate to the primary school from which they came so that they can put it on their wall. Simple thing to do, easy to do. And frankly, whenever I make the point, everybody says, what a wonderful idea. And there's one university, only one university, that started to do it, but I've got a feeling from the way that people were reacting to that there'll be more universities on this side of the water than on that side of the water that start to do it. So there are the values, there are the principles, there are the prejudices. I think they're prejudices. Inclusive about what? And I've missed out the most important one, really. I mean, you've done all this, so we don't want to spend too much time on this. There's obviously, you're trying to be inclusive of race and nationality, religion, inter and intra, and faith, and physical, emotional, I would have said cognitive barriers to learning as well. And I've not put that down. And I would get in there the ability, which I'm certainly not going to talk about here, which is selection, which I gather you did talk about yesterday, at the beginning of the day. Class and wealth, the poverty divide. And now, of course, there'll be a generational divide because we selfish sods won't pay our graduate tax and the next generation are going to have to pay for it. The first generation, our privilege is going to be the first generation to promise a worse future for our children than we had. And finally, gender. I just thought I'd be nasty there, get in. You were all looking too nice. Right, a baker's dozen questions for the inclusive school. So these are really trying to get, and I know the schools concerned are going to have an opportunity to say how wrong some of these are. One question would be, do we assess the child's preferred learning style on entry? And already I can feel lots of minds in the room saying, yes, but. And the yes, but will be a, come on, what are you talking about, preferred learning styles? I don't buy all that nonsense. I like the theory of Howard Gardner, and of course I meet loads of teachers who say, yeah, that's absolutely right. And they say it from the point of view of seeing kids who excel and make progress in different spheres of activity and therefore are attracted to it. But preferred learning style, you don't mean by that, do you, that we want all the kinesthetic learners in one corner and all? No, I don't. And I don't mean that. What I do mean is using that sort of assessment to get, after all, we're perfectly happy, or at least we are on in England, to administer a thing called a CAT test. I'm sure you don't do it here because you've got selection, but secondary schools want to know, in Burtian terms, the general intelligence factor, and that predisposes them towards doing it. I'm making an argument for saying, well, surely it would be as well to know as much as you could about each individual kid, not in terms of well, we'll exclusively saturate them as their preferred learning styles. We'll develop every one of their learning styles, but we need to know where they're stronger and where they're weaker, because we might find that when a kid is not learning something, we can resort to some technique that would work well on that. So how does it inform? The real question underneath this is, how on earth does this inform our learning, our preferred teaching styles, and the organisation of our learning in the school? So that's what I wanted to get at, really. Secondly, do we have at least two timetables for the pupils, one reflecting the wish to proceed simultaneously across a broad, balanced curriculum, if that's what you want to call it, the other offering numerous opportunities to accelerate and consolidate learning according to the learner's interests and needs? So that, I suppose I'm arguing for schools that say, post-primary, again, illustration, French followed by maths on Mondays, etc., or a fortnightly timetable. And incidentally, I don't know if you've got some fortnightly timetables. I bet you have. But it's an interesting proposition to say, is there a difference between a weekly timetable and a fortnightly timetable in terms of the inclusion agenda? I think there is. And the reason I think there is, let me advance the prejudice, as we have the head of post-primary inspections in the room. The reason I think is this. When kids transfer, those who've got the most tenuous hold on their learning, we are always very anxious to make sure that they've come from a primary pattern And it's important that they don't meet too many teachers in the in their early secondary career, post-primary career. So we often say, well, in the first year of secondary school, it's a good idea that kids don't encounter more than 7 or 8, 9, 10 teachers. If you look at secondary timetablers and ask them, the very last thing they do in fitting in the timetable is to say that they don't mind in first year if a kid, if they've got to fit everything in and they start with the exams, then actually it's perfectly all right to have two people teaching history, two people teaching geography, etc. And if you ask the question, a little bit of research, but if you do ask the question, where are there fortnightly timetables? I've never encountered fewer than 16 teachers teaching kids in first year secondary. It was an interesting proposition, but you can see why I would say, well, that is a proposition. That's only my first regular timetable. The intensive timetable is a plea that we don't have timetables that are suspended just for fun, for a week or a day or whatever it may be, but that inspectors would look at and ask, what is the planned set of experiences that are reflected in the week or the day or the fortnight, and with which year group are they planned, and how are they reviewed? I don't think at the moment we do that. We tend to do it serendipitously. Thirdly, have we an agreed set of experiences which between us, the school and the community, we ensure everyone gets? Nice bit of English there. How do these experiences compare with those of other schools? And are those experiences, this was kind of reflecting that perhaps it will be a good idea, and it affects learning style, will it be a good idea to make sure that kids have an expectation that, for instance, they have at least one residential? And what would you do with that residential? And when would it occur? Best if it occurs at the beginning of a school year rather than at the end of a school year when people are going to change the personnel who work with the kids. Are we making sure that they see, that they take full advantage of the Commonwealth of extraordinary treasures that are available within our community? I mean, we're in a city. How many kids in Belfast have been to a theatrical performance? How many kids have been to a musical performance? And do we ensure that it isn't just our kids, I mean our kids, who get to that? So I think having a set of experiences is important to avoid inclusion. Does our library stock resources reflect achievements, failures of people of different ethnicity, nationality, gender and intelligence, and of course ability? How does that vary for different places, for whole, do we involve in that the whole class? Do we involve the parents? Do we involve the pupils in the debate about how that would happen? Do we encourage competition in setted groups and avoid it in mixed ability groups? I'll just leave that hanging in the air, shall I, rather than elaborate. How does everyone in our community have access to our e-learning platform? I grabbed two copies of John Furlong's introduced book about that, because I think he's right. I think some schools have tipped over. They've passed the tipping point. But where I think we haven't done is serious research of the factors that have led to them going over the tipping point. I'm absolutely sure that there are schools now that if you removed all ICT and asked them, because I'm involved a little bit, I now totally lose I probably lost it already, but any vestige of respect you've got for me when I have confessed that I'm on the board of Research Machines. Gasp and take a breath. Would you do that? I mean, is there nothing to which you might sing? when I talk to them, I've got on their board, and it's like being on the governing body of a school. When I say to them, look, you're peddling all this stuff, and I'm totally in favour of it, but where is your evidence of the difference that's been made? They haven't bothered to collect it. Do you see what I mean? And I'm just now on a campaign with Mike Tomlinson, who used to be after Chris Woodhead. You remember Chris? It's all right for you. He was at a distance, I've got to tell you. For those of us who were rather closer, it wasn't a funny experience. But he was a lovely man. Anyway, Mike came after him, and I have to say that that must have been one of the most fortunate things in his career, to be the inspector immediately after him. But he and I are both on this board, and we're just in the middle of writing a paper in which we're saying, come on, we have got to devote resources with researchers to look at case studies of the sort John Furlong was describing, because we know, because I visited some schools which are clearly post the tipping point, and some that are right on the edge of the tipping point. But whenever they kit places out in the summer, you should hear the squeals of fury. This is under Building Schools for the Future, God rest its soul. If things aren't ready for the beginning of term. Now, they vary according to, we can't get all the kids having their lunch, or we can't take the register, or we can't get our vital files, through to, and surely these must be the schools that are tipping point, our teachers can no longer teach without this system being operational. Now, I think that's, in a sense, we might get at where we are. It's a digression from my theme. You're thinking, well, I haven't spotted your theme yet, but please, though I've spotted the digressions, they're incessant and non-stop. It's me varying my style in order to be inclusive, you understand that. definitely it seems to me that there might be something to be said for actually doing a controlled experiment with schools to say, OK, sorry, but next week you're off. What can you not operate now that you could operate? Because I think it's pretty important, certainly as far as we're concerned, because the government that we've now inherited actually doesn't believe that ICT is key to schools at all. So it's pretty important. I think it is. And you've only got to look at kids who are learning to be failures, and I have observed one very, very closely over the last year, to see that actually the technology is a come-on, an attraction in terms of learning that isn't there before. So, and none of us really need persuading of this, do we? I mean, you know, in terms of kids with special educational needs, where would they be without the advances in technology? In terms of access to information, you know, the library, I had the library down at the previous point, where would we be without the technology? In terms of communication, where would we be? So I think it's pretty important. Do we know the names of children looked after in public care? Who do we think are the other pupils at risk of failure? Do our local schools each year, at the end of the year, and this is surely an inclusive litmus test, have a little debate about which kids at the end of that year, in each year group, are at risk of, I don't mean the at risk in terms of the public the sexual issue or the physical abuse. I mean at risk of believing themselves to be failures. And then what do we do in the following year, and surely this is an inclusive practice, in terms of building resilience practices so that those kids are no longer at risk? Once came across a school that did that, and they had certain guiding principles. They had a debate about would it be boys, would it be summer born, you know, would it be all those things? But then which ones were the tutors and the teachers agreeing on? Hit on the names of 30 kids, decided that one of the things they could do would be that every member of staff would have a conversation with this kid post-primary. Every member of staff would be allocated 3 names, and they would talk to those kids and find out as much about them as they could during the course of the next year in conversations, in corridors, etc., etc. At the end of the year, those kids were not considered to be at risk. Mind you, there are another 10 or 15 who were, but there you go. How do we ensure that poverty is not a barrier to children accessing the curriculum? How do we ensure that everybody has access to materials and trips? What's their performance? Do we know the performance of kids who are entitled to free school meals in the English context? I think you've got that here, haven't you? And do we know? Do we know the difference that's made? Did you know there was a school in Widnes that performs 6 times better for kids who are poor than any other secondary school in the country? Ofsted has not discovered that, but an interesting guy who runs the Fisher Family Trust, which you may have heard of or may not have heard of, he has discovered that. And we are analysing together what that might mean. Do we allocate resources on the basis of differentiated children's needs rather than the same share for everyone? That's at the heart of the one-to-one. I'm sure all schools are rather better at doing this, incidentally, than those at government level who are distributing resources. And how far are our pupils engaged in restorative activities and practices? By that, I you know what I mean by that, don't you? I don't need to go, yes, good. So we'll move on from there. Do we have regrets? Do we have targets? We all have regrets. Do we have targets for each member of staff CPD for ways in which in the next year everyone can extend our knowledge of inclusive practice? That's back to my anecdote right at the beginning of the Chartered London Teacher. How do we measure our progress as an inclusive school? And how does the detail of our teaching, learning and assessment policy and practice reflect an inclusive approach so that our teachers are well informed about the skills of questioning? Are they well informed about the need to differentiate story and explanation? What is our marking policy? Is that inclusive or exclusive? I think almost every aspect of school is susceptible to this sort of analysis. Now, I've focused heavily on the schools, partly because I know the schools are following me and they can immediately say what rubbish all this is. But also to advance the proposition that it seems to me that it's those who are in the first eye of your three eyes of initial induction and inset. I know they are crucial to the whole thing, but those who are involved in the first eye, the initial teacher trainers in particular, and those who are involved in the third eye, inset, are likely to include lots of those in the audience in this conference today. And that's your business. I wonder how far it is incumbent on you to have a debate with those schools you work with, either by way of postgraduate students or by way of placements in the first eye, to say, hey, come on, what we're trying to promote is the following, and what are your practices locally in terms of inclusion? In other words, don't take my inclusion, but use that as a prompt, as it were, for deciding what will be an exclusive school of those connected, I don't know, with Limerick University or whatever it may be. What would their practices be, and how would they say, okay, what unites us is doing this sort of a thing? So what are you all going to do about it? Whether it's the diocese, whether it's the assembly, whether it's the government, whether it's the departments. I understand that the RTU is unique. Tom told me it was. Is it you as teacher trainers? Is it you as governors? And what's the media doing? What's the media's approach to an inclusive agenda? And the dangers ahead. Cuts, isolation, separation. My experience of that in the 70s and 80s was exactly that is what happened around me. That there were cuts. And what followed cuts was isolation and what followed that was The Devil Take the Hindmost, really. And I'm bothered about that, and it leads me into saying that in already in a conversation with Tony, who's speaking to you later, I was very, very taken with his enthusiasm, always been taken with your enthusiasm, but your enthusiasm for partnerships of schools working together. I think we must encourage that. And it doesn't, it could be the initial trainers and the inset providers of trainers who encourage such partnerships and lay on opportunities for people working with each other. And that's partly because I was once very attracted by this. I sat at the back of a conference hall where people were talking about learning. And a guy put up, you may have come across him, a guy called John West Burnham. He shoved up this slide, and I thought, I'll pinch that. That's a good one. Which is that if you're a dependent learner, think of it, it is shallow learning usually. And when you become an independent learner, it becomes deep. You know, what joy it is when you become an autonomous learner and can learn things. And finally, when you become an interdependent learner, it becomes profound. Ask any of the winners of the Nobel Prize, and it's not an individual operation, it's a group operation. So it becomes profound when you've got the confidence to work with others and collectively understand that you are going to come up with things and you're going to learn things that are way beyond that. Try applying that to institutions, because teachers will recognise that, leaders of schools will recognise that, and then apply it to institutions, which I think in a way, and I hope he's going to talk about his partnerships idea. He is, good. Then I think when it's applied to schools as institutions, particularly when there's nobody operating the system, or those operating the system have fallen into a kind of limbo, which, forgive me, but it seems to me is likely to be a worrying case, not merely in Northern Ireland. I don't know about the South, but I'm dead certain that's going to apply and is beginning to apply in England as well. It's tremendously important that somehow or other we promote interdependence of institutions. And finally, before I set you your task, which now you'll be delighted to know is not going to be half an hour, but around about 5 minutes, and you're thinking, my God, it felt like 2 hours. There's a lovely quote here from Pablo Casals, and I thought I'd end with two more quotes, partly because I thought, well, they've had to put up with me. If I've given them a couple of quotes here and there that they like and use, well, at least I might have caught that moment of providing you something which was worthwhile rather than informing or misinforming you or entertaining you or not entertaining you. So I like this one. Sometimes, I bet you know it, I sometimes look around me with a feeling of complete dismay and the confusion that afflicts the world today. I see a disrespect for the very values of life. Beauty is all around us. Don't you like the way I read it? But how many seem to see nothing? Each second we live is a new and unique moment of the universe. A moment that will never be again. And what do we teach our children? We teach them that 2 and 2 make 4 and that Paris is the capital of France. When will we also teach them what they are? We should say to each of them, do you know what you are? You're a marvel. You're unique. In all the world, there's no other child exactly like you. In the millions of years that have passed, there's never been another child like you. And look at your body, what a wonder it is. Your legs, your arms, your cunning fingers, the way you move. I like this sentence. I used it frequently in Birmingham when they would say that we've got loads of kids from the mere poor, and what more can you expect? They come from illiterate rural backgrounds. And I used to say, yeah, but just think what talent may be there. There's been no creaming. There just may be another Shakespeare, another Beethoven, another Michelangelo. And when you grow up, can you then hurt another like you, who is like you, a marvel? You must cherish one another. We must work, as we all must work, to make this world worthy of its children. And finally, I don't need to do it, do I? You know this one too. The Reggio Emilia movement in Italy. And that wonderful, wonderful piece by the founder. The child is made of 100, the child has 100 languages, 100 ways of thinking, of playing, of speaking. 100, always 100 ways of listening, of marvelling, of loving, 100 joys for singing and understanding, 100 worlds to discover, 100 worlds to invent, 100 worlds to dream. And the child has 100 languages and 100 more, but they steal 99. The school and the culture separate the head from the body. They tell the child to think without hands, to do without head, to listen and not to speak, to understand without joy, and to love and to marvel only at Easter and Christmas. They tell the child to discover the world already there, and of the 100, they steal 99. They tell the child that work and play, reality and fantasy, science and imagination, sky and earth, reason and dream, are things that do not belong together, and thus they tell the child that the 100 isn't there. The child says, no way, the 100 is there. It's a super description of how we should approach the children and at the heart of an inclusive practitioner. So I cannot get away from the fact that it isn't merely the knowledge that our teachers, our leaders, and our system leaders bring to the system. It isn't merely their knowledge, their learning, and that they're learned people. It's their dispositions. Are they energy creators? Are they what if, how about, let's do people, or are they people who are essentially energy consumers? You are all, by definition, energy creators, and your job has never, never been more important than now, faced with the cuts, the prospect. It's absolutely plain that you ought to share with each other the secrets of putting an inclusive system into practice. So as I finish, you've got exactly 2 minutes to do what I set you to do, and you aren't going to do it. So I'll let you off the task, but will you promise me later that you will resolve, as a result of this morning, to get some like-minded people together locally and to debate the practices that you think you could adjust that would have a significant impact on inclusive practice close to you? Thank you for being such a patient.
And now to follow that was wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Brickhouse, Sir Brickhouse. We're not quite sure where we'll go in the titles. They're going to work here on the laptop for a moment. I'm reminded the President of Ireland came to our college recently, and she spoke to us about two types of people. She said there were radiators and there were brains. And she said that the world needs lots of radiators, people who can enthuse, inspire, give, be generous. But we're all doomed to meet a lot more drains than we do radiators. And I think you'll understand what drains are, who they are. I think this morning we've been very fortunate to have a wonderful radiator with us who has given us plenty of food for thought and who has challenged us to think what it is we can do differently. And I know that we all work in different contexts, and having an inclusive school or inclusive college is very important to us all. And in our context, we are just begun a program called the Certificate of Contemporary Living, which is open to young adults with intellectual disabilities. And what it has done, it has brought onto our campus in the Faculty of Education in Limerick 20 young people, all of whom who have intellectual difficulties and learning difficulties and barriers to learning, may they be physical or intellectual as well. And it has meant that we have had to change lots of things, how we get in and out of buildings, how we schedule timetables. Every individual in our college has had to change and think creatively about what we do and how we do it. So it's been a really positive experience for us. So creating inclusive environments can do so much. Before I forget it, I want to thank our two signers who've been doing a wonderful job today. We had two signers yesterday. They've been wonderful. Thank you so much. And Tim spoke about inspiration. And yesterday, we were speaking about the difficulty of having policy and then implementing that policy. And I think Verity and Amanda spoke about the sources of inspiration that are out there for us. And this morning we have four speakers. who I think will bring us more of the ideas, the sources of inspiration of what is happening in schools. And sometimes, you know, we can be seen as a group of fuddy-duddies who are thinking about policy or in teacher education, but we really don't know what happens when the rubber hits the road. And so these are the people who are going to tell us how well we're doing and how well they're doing in relation to their schools and their experiences. So I want to welcome the first speaker this morning, again, is, look at my list, is Michael Dobbins. And Michael is principal of a special school, Foyle View Special School in Derry. So you're very welcome, Michael.
Good morning, everybody. This is the sound of the rubber hitting the road now. My name's Michael Dobbins. I'm the principal of Foyle.